Greetings, friends. It's another edition of the Pro Football Weekly podcast. We are thrilled, as always, that you are with us today. And as promised, we are going to continue our stroll around the NFL. We're going division by division, breaking down all 32 teams before training camp. And today we are going to discuss the AFC North. It's an interesting division, to be sure. You've got the Bengals and Steelers, both playoff teams. You've got the Ravens, really perennial postseason teams prior to last year. And, well, then you have the Browns. But we're going to get you up to speed on all of them today. And we're going to start, actually, right off the bat with the Baltimore Suns' Jeff Zriebeck, who's going to get us up to speed on the Ravens. I am pleased to be joined by Jeff Zriebeck of the Baltimore Sun. Jeff doing an excellent job covering the Ravens over for the Sun. If you're not following him on Twitter, make sure you are doing so at Jeff Zriebeck. It's Zriebeck. That's the Twitter handle. Go there and give it a follow. Jeff, thanks so much for joining us. How are you doing today?
My pleasure. Good talking to you.
For sure. The pleasure is all mine, and I will go ahead and just kind of leap right into the Ravens discussion. Obviously, coming off a down year, probably pretty unusual covering that type of a season for a John Harbaugh club, I'd imagine.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they got off to such a poor start, and then the injuries started mounting. It was pretty clear by, you know, maybe late October that, you know, this was not going to be a playoff team. I mean, and they had made the playoffs every other year but one under Harbaugh. And even that other year, it went down in the last week of the season where they had a chance to get in. So no question. It was one of the more tumultuous years of franchise history with the number of guys that went out and how badly they struggled at times. Some of it was bad luck, but I think the season revealed that, you know, they were hurt by a couple of, you know, they haven't drafted as well in recent years. They've had some misses. They've had some long-term contract extensions that didn't work out. And frankly, when you saw them play teams like the Seahawks, other teams like that last year, that they were overmatched. The Bengals, I mean, they were overmatched. I have no idea how they swept the Steelers. That's just a rivalry thing. But you know, there was definitely a difference in talent, athleticism, speed from the Ravens and their opponents last year. And they certainly have a ways to go and some improvements to make before they, you know, can say right now that, we're back to being a playoff team.
I want to circle back here in a moment to ask you about some of that, you know, talent deficiencies and maybe where Ozzie Newsome has struggled. Obviously, one of the best decision makers, one of the best executives in all of football, but everyone is going to have some misses. We'll get back to that in a minute, but I feel like I have to start with the health issue, and I just can't remember really another situation with so many key veterans coming off of big injuries. You just kind of laid it out well, calling it one of the tumultuous seasons in the franchise history, so I'm guessing you agree, but where are some of these key guys we'll start on offense at? What do you expect for Joe Flacco coming off the ACL, Steve Smith at 37 coming off, obviously the Achilles, and then Breshad Perriman, who we haven't seen on the field yet. I know these are hopefully going to be, well, obviously with Flacco and Smith, but you know, kind of key components of the offense.
Yeah, I agree with you. I don't think there's another team in the NFL that goes into this coming season with as many questions, you know, at least health questions, about the status of their most prominent players. And you can go position by position. You know, we'll start on offense because those are guys you mentioned, but it extends defensively. It's funny, Flacco, who had knee surgery to repair both a torn ACL and MCL in December, he seems to be one of the guys they're least concerned about. We saw him, you know, as important as he is to the team, he's kind of been ahead of schedule. Now, they held him back. He didn't participate in any of the mandatory mini camp or the OTAs. He was out there. He just wasn't participating. But he's been running for a while. He's been making all the throws for a while. He's pretty far along. I think when they open practice, their first practice will be on July 28th. Joe Flacco is expected to be under center. He's ahead of schedule. He's passed all the tests, as I said. You know, but he's pretty much the only one of those prominent guys you mentioned that we know for sure is going to be out there. Now, you know, Forsett broke his arm last year. He's back. He should be fine. Crockett Gilmore, their starting tight end, shoulder surgery. he should be fine. These guys have both been on the field throughout the summer. Steve Smith just really started ramping up his running. Steve Smith has never pinpointed training camp. In fact, I wouldn't be surprised if we only see him for a couple of weeks. I don't expect him to play in the preseason. He had the Achilles injury in November, I think it was. So I think he's on making progress. He put up a tweet the other day of him sprinting, which is the first we've seen that. But there's no date. He's not planning to be out in the field anytime soon. So I think if they get him back midway through training camp or even later than that and get him some, allow him to work off the rust, then, they'd be fine with that. But again, we're talking about, a receiver of that age who knows how he's going to be able to react to an Achilles. This is the most serious injury he's ever had. So those are the big ones on offense that are the concern. I mean, but, and then you go to tight end and you still have Dennis Pitta. What will he be able to do? I think he's played 7 games in the last 3 years after fracturing, dislocating his hip twice. Anything he gives them probably would be a bonus, but he should be out there. So that's definitely a boost for the team.
And then the one guy we didn't mention a ton, what about Rashad Perryman? Obviously, they're hoping more than him being out there and a bonus there. What can you tell us about, did he have a setback with the knee this offseason, and what are your expectations for him?
Yeah, I missed that one. But again, it's unfortunate.
Hey, I don't blame you. It's a laundry list.
Yeah, you
it's
just hard to track. I've never seen him on the field, really. I mean, and I'm not taking a shot at him. But, he looked great in the OTAs, and he's finally, first of all, the kid was smiling and it sounds cheesy and all that, but this kid's had a really rough go of it. His dad, Brett Perryman, had a stroke this offseason, former NFL receiver. His best friend was Trey Walker, who passed away, and he missed all of his rookie year and he did not handle it well. He kind of was tough to talk to, kind of kept to himself, was just so depressed about not being out there. So for team officials to see him out on the field, running around looking healthy and happy, engaged with his teammates, it was a great sign for team officials. And then he hurt his knee on another freak play again. And, they don't think it's serious. He got his knee scoped. They don't think it's anything. I think he should be ready at some point during training camp. Another guy who they'll probably take it slow with, but they're encouraged that he'll be ready in plenty of time to be out there on September 11th against the Buffalo Bills in the regular season opener. However, every time you talk about Perryman, you have to note that last year, what was supposed to be a day-to-day injury wound up keeping him out the entire season. So I think there's some question about how he'll recover. Is this more serious than they're letting on? We don't know. They claim it's not. But you have to put that out there with Rashad Perryman. His last year's injury was not supposed to be serious, and it wiped him out over his entire rookie season.
Right, right. And, you mentioned at the top, Ozzie Newsome has certainly, I don't think, lost his fastball. You didn't say that, but more so has had some misses like they're all going to. And I'm guessing that some of the draft misses are on defense, and I'll let you kind of fill us in on that in a moment. But you mentioned a couple free agent signings that went a bit haywire. I'm sure one of them you're referring to is Eugene Monroe. Just get us quickly up to speed on that offensive line without Eugene Monroe. Maybe was that strictly a performance-based decision? And then obviously, of course, Baltimore also trying to replace Osemele. How is that unit going to respond? Because certainly with Flacco coming off the injury, they need it to be much better.
Yeah, Monroe was one of the primary long-term deals that didn't really work out. Darius Webb, because of injuries, hasn't worked out really. And Jimmy Smith, the quarterback, has struggled to stay on the field a little, but there's still high hopes for him. In response to Monroe, there's no doubt his passionate advocacy for medical marijuana testing was a little head-scratching to team officials because there's been questions about Eugene Monroe's passion to play football, how much he wanted it, fair or unfair. I'm not the guy that's going to judge that. I'm not around him every day. I'm never going to question a player's want to or heart. That's not, I don't know enough. I don't see enough to be able to do that. However, whether it's fair or unfair, there was kind of a stigma there that maybe Eugene didn't love football as much. So when they saw him, breathlessly tweeting every day about medical marijuana, you have to be honest. I'm sure it raised some eyebrows. around the facility. However, the Ravens have a long list and a long history of guys who have spoken out about different things. Brendan Iambadejo was a big one about, gay marriage and that issue. And Matt right. Burke at the time was opposed to it. So they didn't cut either of those guys. It was not, maybe a factor. Maybe they were worried it was a distraction at some point. And it was interesting to some people for how Eugene was on other things. The bottom line is the guy started and finished three games last year. Just three. He played in six and started and finished just three. They lost faith in the fact that he was going to be out there and he was going to be able to play and stay healthy. And when you sign Joe Flacco all that money and you have zero faith in your franchise, in your left tackle, that's an issue. And it became time. The Ravens and Monroe did not see eye to eye about several things. They asked him to take a contract restructure. He said no. They asked him to get a little bigger. Eugene's a big fitness guy. He wanted to be a little leaner and do things his way. Eugene's his own man, and he's a very bright guy, smart guy, and he works hard, but he works hard on the things he views he should be working hard on. And as I said, it was just a deal that he really never fully bought into the idea of how the Ravens do things. And it was time for a change. The injuries and his durability issues were the biggest problems. And then they had an opportunity to grab a franchise left tackle. So you'll see Stanley start from day one at left tackle. You have Yonda back at right guard. Zuda's healthy again after hip surgery. It was bicep surgery, I think. Either way, Zuda's healthy again at center. So he's back. Their entire center on the right side is back with Yonda and then Rick Wagner at right tackle. The one guy in question mark is obviously Osemele leaving. And John Urschel, everyone's favorite mathematician, he's played a lot of football in his past 2 years, started a lot of games for their injuries. He's the favorite to play in that spot. They also like a guy named Ryan Jensen, who former draft pick, who started six or seven games for them there last year. So they're not as good as Osemele was, and I think they're going to miss him, especially in the running game where he's just nasty. I don't consider the offensive line a concern right now. If there was a concern, it would be the natural one. How does Ronnie Stanley, adapt to the NFL, and how quickly will he get up to speed? Because, protecting the blind side can be a lonely place if you're struggling.
Yeah, no doubt about it. Spending just a couple more minutes here chatting with Jeff Zrebiak of the Baltimore Sun, getting us up to speed on the Ravens and kind of switching sides to defense. And I hate to kind of go back to the injury discussion, but I think that's where it starts, obviously, at outside linebacker. How did this defense kind of weather the absence of Terrell Suggs last year? And now with Elvis Duverville also coming off foot surgery and Suggs, I'll let you update us on his rehab, but kind of what are the expectations for that position and maybe what's in the pipeline if these guys, because realistically, these guys now in their 30s really do start to slide.
Yeah, the defense last year for the first half of the season was really struggled. And then for the last eight games, statistics can be skewed in any way, but the Ravens had one of the top defenses statistically for the last eight games. And as I said, they weren't fooled into thinking they had all the answers. They made some adjustments. One of those adjustments was using Lardarius Webb more at safety. That's going to be the position he's playing going forward. But the fact is, Suggs' injury in the season opener last year killed them. Even their owner, Steve Bisciotti, said it was the biggest thing we couldn't overcome because it forced Elvis Dumervil to play every down. Elvis Dumervil is not an every down player. He's more of a situational rusher. And he plays hard, but he's still a little undersized, and he got wore down last year, Dumervil, and his numbers showed that. And he was also dealing with injuries, but he didn't leave the field. Suggs is the million-dollar question on this team because he has not spoken to the media since leading into that season-opening game where he tore his Achilles last year in Denver. He's another guy that does things his way. He stays to himself. He's not a big being around the building guy in the off season. Not a guy that talks much to reporters unless he's obligated to do it during the year. So he's a mystery. Of all the injured players, they all talk during the mandatory minicamp. Terrell Suggs released a statement through the PR that said really nothing. He's been working hard. They insist he's been in the building for the last month and a half or so. They expect him to be ready for the season. But it is interesting. We've gotten all these updates of Steve Smith, who tore his Achilles about a month and a half, 2 months after Suggs. We've not heard anything on Suggs' Achilles really that pinpoints a definitive timetable for when we can expect to see him on the field. And when he tore his Achilles, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, Suggs was back in 5 months, which was obscene at the time. So we didn't expect that this year, but we're almost going on 10 months and we don't know when he's going to play. So Suggs is definitely a mystery here. If there's one guy other than obviously your franchise quarterback who hasn't played in a while, everyone's going to be looking at Joe Flacco come their first practice. Whenever Suggs is out there for the first time, that's going to be a significant story because where's he at? You know, he's 33, getting up there. We don't know how much football he has left, and now he's torn his Achilles twice in a 4 or 5 year span. The Ravens did address the position. They did add pass rushers. They drafted Kamalee Correa from Boise State in the second round. They drafted Matt Judon from Grand Valley State a little later. They signed Victor Ochi, who's a priority free agent and can rush the passer. Za'Darius Smith, a rookie last year, who had 4.5, 5 sacks as a rookie, really came on. He's going to fill Courtney Upshaw's role, but he's a better pass rusher than Upshaw ever was. Bronson Kafusi, their third-round pick from BYU, is a guy who's more of an interior rusher, but he can get to the passer. The Ravens spent all offseason trying to get more athletic on offense, and you saw, the Mike Wallace signing was a big part of that. And on defense, they've tried to improve that pass rush, and they know their secondary is question marks, but the best way to kind of mask that is to get a better rush. And all the great Ravens defenses have been able to get to the quarterback. Last year's couldn't, so they're hoping some of their young players will really improve their pass rush this year.
And last one I have for you, Jeff, is kind of about that secondary. I guess it's kind of a more general question, but it relates to the secondary. The insertion of Eric Weddle, I love the signing. I know it was kind of trying to maybe make up for the miss with Matt Elam and trying to, you know, replace Ed Reed as they've been trying to do for years. But how much does Weddle's addition mean not only to the secondary, not only to the transition for Ladarius Webb, but what about from a leadership standpoint? Because I think they lost a lot of it when Daryl Smith left and Chris Canty left. Is he also being looked at to kind of help in that area right away? Is that too much to ask?
Yeah, no, not at all. That was part of the reason they wanted to sign him. This team has seriously lacked kind of a general at the back end of their defense. There's been communication errors galore. They've gotten beat on, they've given up a ton of long balls. Obviously cornerback play is factored, but they really have lacked a guy that can kind of take charge back there, get people lined up in the right place and make plays, on the ball. And that's what they hope Weddle does. They told, it reminds me a little when Steve Smith came over and there was all this talk about Steve Smith's attitude and being a club, a locker room lawyer or a kind of a tough locker room guy. The Ravens told Steve Smith, we want everything about Steve Smith, whether that's fighting in training camp, we'll deal with that. Whether it's yelling at a teammate or demanding the ball, we want you to be yourself. They told Weddle that same thing. They don't want him to change. They don't want him to suppress his personality. Heck, they even told him to grow his beard back. They want the guy that was a good player in San Diego and his own personality. And Eric Weddle definitely is that. Above all, I think we've seen year by year, they've lost a ton of kind of, for lack of a better term, alpha males on that defense. It goes to Ray Lewis and Ed Reed leaving after the Super Bowl, and there's been so many, Haloti Ngata. They had a bunch of take charge, whether they weren't necessarily vocal leaders, some were. They certainly were kind of butt kickers on the field and guys the team looked up to, defensive players, and they've just lost so many of those guys over the years. Even Pernell McPhee. Pernell McPhee quietly was one of the defensive leaders. People really looked at him. He got on teammates. They haven't had that type of personality. Daryl Smith was a very strong, steady, smart player, a guy that they had a ton of respect for. So they need to start bringing in some more guys kind of, that'll take charge a little bit, demand accountability among teammates, not have so many quiet guys. And I think that was part of it with Eric Weddle. They want a guy to quarterback their defense, sort of like, Flacco does for the offense. And, C.J. Mosley's moving in Daryl Smith's position. He'll be the middle, probably have the radio in his helmet, But C.J. Mosley's a quiet guy, so I think Weddle will really help kind of rally that group. And, you know, Suggs is a leader. Doomerville can lead, but they need more guys, especially with kind of some of the question marks of whether Doomerville and Suggs, when they'll be on the field.
Right, right. That's Jeff Zrebeck of the Baltimore Sun. It's about all the time we have today, but Jeff, I greatly appreciate it. Hope we can get you back really soon. On the way out, I really just want you to give me one name, but I have to feed the fantasy football nuts. It's a crowded backfield. A lot of people are excited about Kenneth Dixon, Justin Forsett, just 2 years removed from the huge year. Who's the running back that fantasy football owners should be eyeing in the Baltimore Ravens backfield?
Yeah, I still think Justin Forsett's the guy because he's the most complete. And, you know, Buck Allen fumble has had struggles with fumbles. He's also, you know, struggled in pass protection. Forsett's still their top runner. I think he's going to get every chance to be the lead guy, but they're going to go with the hot hand. You know, if I'm a fantasy owner, Forsett would be the guy I'd target first, but I would sort of temper my expectations because of how many guys they got. Their running back situation is going to be tough. I know fantasy owners hate, right, you know, these committee things. In that case, I'd probably stay away from the Ravens, but if I was going to pick one, I'd still lean towards Forsett. Dixon ultimately will be the guy. Maybe he'll be the guy in time for the fantasy playoffs. But right now, I think you have to lean towards Forsett as their top fantasy running back.
All right. There it is, folks. Jeff Zrebeck of the Baltimore Sun. Jeff, thank you so much. And if it's not asking too much, I'm going to have you come back again sooner than later because so much good content here.
Sure. I enjoyed it at any time.
All right, Jeff. Enjoy the rest of your downtime. We will talk to you very soon. That's Jeff Zrebeck of the Baltimore Sun getting us caught up on the Ravens, and we'll continue our spin around the AFC North next. Welcome back to the Pro Football Weekly podcast. We are pleased to be joined next by Jim Wexel of Steel City Insider, the publisher over there at the Scout Network, also Pro Football Weekly correspondent. You can find Jim's Steelers preview in the 2016 Pro Football Weekly Preview magazine, available on newsstands now. Jim, thanks again for joining us. How are you doing today?
I'm good, Arthur. Thanks for having me.
Of course, the pleasure is ours. And if you aren't already following Jim on Twitter, you should be doing so. His handle at Jim Wexel, W-E-X-E-L-L. So make sure you head over there and give him a follow. Jim, I guess I'll just kind of launch right in. The Steelers offense is going to be a juggernaut again. I think we can safely say that. But what do you think about moving on? I know it's kind of old news at this point, but it's the first chance we've had to talk. Moving on from Martavis Bryant, is Sammy Coates ready to step up? Do they need Sammy Coates to step up when you have all-world Antonio Brown and all-world Le'Veon Bell in the backfield? What happens next? How does this offense kind of move on? Obviously, moving on from Heath Miller as well, of course.
Well, before I move into Sammy Coates, let's start with the starters, Marcus Wheaton. Now, Marcus suffered a mysterious injury late in the spring, and he did not look well walking around on it. So, and of course, you know how it is trying to get injury information from anyone 2 days before they go away for the rest of the summer. So Marcus Wheaton will be somebody to keep an eye on in training camp just to see how serious that injury is or was. Two, Darius Heyward-Bey is one of the hardest workers on the team. They all love him. You know, the former cast-off. He's got deep speed. And, you know, Ben Roethlisberger loves a big, deep target. His record with Plaxico Burress and Martavis Bryant is unbelievable. It's like a 900 win percentage. So he loves a big man deep. And Darius Heyward-Bey is that guy. And the coaches love him. Coaches love a veteran. And I suspect Darius Heyward-Bey will get a lot of work early. So, yeah. If Marcus Wheaton is down, Darius Heyward-Bey will be a guy they'll lean on early. You know how coaches are. And you know how they are with veterans who work hard and are deserving.
Sure,
All of that said, nobody's had a better offseason than Sammy Coates. Wow. He dropped a lot of weight. He thought his conditioning was poor last year, and you wouldn't have known it to look at him. He looked as in shape as any NFL wide receiver. But he really turned it up and got himself in shape. But I don't know how he got his hands in shape because last year they were rock hard. And you could tell this guy was a 50-50 proposition to catch any ball. And wow, he is just, he's a new guy this spring. He was a new guy. So he's more confident. He's in better shape, and he has the opportunities in front of him. But I gave you the murky waters that could get in his way early. But Stanley Coates is definitely a guy to keep an eye on.
You know, I wouldn't necessarily categorize Darius Heyward Bey. Obviously, I don't think he'll ever be called a consistent catcher, but some of the stone hands you just alluded to with Coates obviously have plagued Heyward Bey throughout his career. Do you think maybe the youngster's been leaning on the vet kind of, you know, with how to maybe overcome some of those growing pains?
I don't know. I wouldn't lean on him.
He's got still not
right.
A good catcher.
it's odd. A guy like Lima Sweet a few years ago, he dropped a couple deep balls and was banished forever. Darius Heyward Bey can keep coming back. For whatever reason, the coaches just love him. And they seem to excuse these drops. And they still happen. And they happened in the spring again. But for whatever reason, he keeps coming back. You know, he's a guy that wants to work on special teams. He's a guy that wants to help young guys. So, yes, I don't know that Sammy went to him, but I'm sure Darius reached out to Sammy Coates for whatever help he needs. Because DHB is that kind of guy. He's well-liked by teammates and coaches.
So we know how Kevin Colbert has been able to make sure that the wide receiver pipeline is consistently full. I've been impressed. You let Kelvin Beachum walk. He's coming off the injury. I believe Kelvin Beachum is a former seventh rounder. Correct me if I'm wrong on that. And then you're going to plug in Alejandro Villanueva, who has a fascinating backstory, but obviously the opposite of a high pedigree, typical first round left tackle. Just the exact opposite, of course. What's going on with that O-line and Villanueva now slotted in at left tackle? It looks like it's going to have a chance to be a strength if he can hold down that spot like he did last year.
Right, and if he can hold it down, Ryan Harris should be able to.
Sure,
I mean, he won a Super Bowl as a left tackle last year. If not, they have a swing tackle. I would imagine Villanueva is going to get first crack. There are a number of reasons why Beachum didn't get the money he wanted. I mean, one was the injury. Do you give that much money, a left tackle type money, to a guy coming off an injury? And two, he's rather small. I mean, he was a seventh round pick. Then again, Villanueva wasn't drafted at all. But, you know, Beach was the kind of guy that, and guys like Todd Haley just that disagree with me totally, but I always thought Beach would be a guy that you look to replace, at least until he's completely established. And that injury did set that back. But Villanueva is the 6'9 classic, you know, if you ever want Tony Boselli playing left tackle for you, this guy might be able to get it for you on the cheap. So, and if he can't do it, then they do have Ryan Harris, and they did draft a fourth rounder to develop as a project as the number four guy. So I think the offensive line could you know, I hate to just dismiss Beachum because there were so many things he did well, but boy, this could be their best offensive line since the 2005 team had Harding, Faneca, and all those guys.
That's a scary thought. We are chatting with Jim Wexel of Steel City Insider, also Pro Football Weekly correspondent. Find his Steelers scouting report in the 2016 Pro Football Weekly Preview magazine, as well as all of his great stuff at the Scout Network, Steel City Insider. With this offense, Jim, I could ask questions all day. It's just it's beyond an embarrassment of riches. But I think that the more important questions likely are going to come on defense, obviously, and what's going to kind of determine how far this team can go this year. Where are you looking at on defense first and foremost? Is it in the secondary where there were all kinds of issues and there could be three new starters this year? Is it an outside linebacker where it seems like there's nothing proven beyond really, really old James Harrison? What are you looking at on the defense in terms of where they're going to find corrections?
Don't let James hear you say really, really old. He'll show you really, really young and
I'm trusting he's not going to be listening to our podcast. I hope I'm okay there.
Oh, you never know. And I tell you what, I love this little battle he's got going with the commissioner. I have every faith that he has not taken any kind of drugs to get as strong as he is, because I remember the first day he walked onto campus, he was as strong as he was stronger than anyone in the field. There were some things he did really poorly, but strength was never an issue with this guy. So I think he is just taunting the NFL commissioner. You know, use the hair thing. Test me for drugs from way back. I have the confidence in him. But I find it amusing that he's going to battle with the commissioner over this. But, yes, the outside linebacker position is a question mark, not because of James, but because of their two former number one draft picks. Jarvis Jones did not pick up his option, so he's looking to play out his free agency next year with a good year this year. He's just not shown much. And Bud Dupree had 4 sacks in 4 games, but I believe somebody at maybe Pro Football Focus recounted that not one of his sacks was he assigned a blocker. Wow. I know one he dragged down Brady on a chase thing from behind. So he beat very few blockers. He mm-hmm. has the athletic ability. The only reason I bring him up and not give him the benefit of the doubt of needing some experience is because Jarvis Jones is appearing to be a washout.
Right.
And, you know, I hate to use the term washout, but, you know, the guy was a first-round pick, and he's just not an explosive pass rusher. And so far, neither is Dupree and James. At 38 years old, upcoming, he'll be 38. He is their best pass rusher still. So, yes, that is a big problem. The secondary, sure, that's a problem. They were 30th ranked last year. Bad news is they lost 3 of 5 starters. The good news is the 30th ranked pass defense lost 3 of 5 starters. So, I mean, you could look at that either way. Right. If I use that in my preview piece, I apologize for using it again, but I really like it.
I do too. That's quite all right. That's good stuff.
But you understand what I'm saying. They have to improve just by bringing in new players. And I think they will. 2 high draft picks. I don't know how much Artie Burns is going to play. I have a feeling he's going to be the number 4 corner. You have Will Gay is a solid guy they like and they've had for years. On the other side, it looks like Ross Cockrell is going to start camp as a starter. Senquez Golson, in theory, is going to go up against him, and Artie Burns will be given a chance. But I think Cockrell is going to hold them off and start the season number 1 over there. And Senquez Golson will be the nickel guy. I think he's going to get a lot of work inside if he can stay healthy. He's a little guy, but he showed a lot more tiger in him this spring than he did the previous spring. And I think we all remember Senquez Golson out of Ole Miss with, we have 10 interceptions his last season there, and he was a second-round draft pick.
Right.
And then Artie Burns is a number 4, and he does need time. He came out a year early. There's a lot to like about his tools, but the reason he wasn't considered a consensus first-round pick is because of some of his inconsistency, and he does need time. He's going to need some time. So, he should have time to develop as a number 4 guy.
And,
the other slot guy will be the...
No, go ahead, please. Sorry.
Okay. The other slot guy will be a safety. The second-round pick, Sean Davis, who played corner at Maryland last year. So they have a 3-safety nickel package that they used a lot in the spring. So that will be something to watch in training camp, how well Sean Davis can cover slot receivers, tight ends. Mainly he's going to cover tight ends. And I think primarily they're looking at guys like Tyler Eifert and Rob Gronkowski. You know,
right.
The Steelers they're not messing around. They're going for the top of the AFC. And those are the guys they have to get covered. And so the other safeties, Rob Golden, will hold that strong safety spot down until Sean Davis develops into a starting safety. That's the theory. And the other guy is Mike Mitchell, who came on really well last year in his second year with the team. Mike Mitchell as a free safety. So the secondary is going to get better. And just maybe these better athletes aren't going to be ready mentally and understanding the pro game, but they're going to be better athletes. And by the end of the year, that secondary will be much better than last year's.
Jim, you kind of read my mind. I was going with the Sean Davis question. It is going to be fascinating to see how the youngsters kind of are able to establish themselves in the secondary and how early. Unfortunately, our time with Jim Wexel is running short already. I don't know where it goes, but I do want to ask you on the way out, Jim, Just your impression of Keith Butler. I know that the rankings weren't great. Obviously, he didn't have a ton of personnel at his disposal in the first year as the replacement for Dick LeBeau. But what do you think about him heading into year two? What do you think about the scheme? Because there have been some rumblings that they're getting away or already have gotten away from that, the 3-4 zone blitzing scheme that we're so used to seeing under LeBeau for years and years and years.
Well, I don't lose my soul for saying this, but I think Dick LeBeau's scheme needed some fine tuning. And for the most part, it's the same. Keith has changed some things and he's made it a little more unpredictable. And I think Dick LeBeau's scheme was getting predictable. I think he was getting a little predictable with the talent he had. It's only natural. You do the same thing for so many years and you trust in it. Guys like Tom Brady are going to get it. And, Tom Brady beat him up pretty good, consistently. And Dick LeBeau did have his moments against the Patriots. But Keith Butler has a bit of a curveball. He's a bit of an oddball, and he does some different things. He blitzes more. He's doing some of the things Dick used to do when Dick was younger in the 90s, bring more corners, more safeties. And that's interesting. It can blow up in his face. Like one time there was a miscommunication, and both corners blitzed. So that was not a good thing.
Uh-oh.
You like a corner blitz every now and then, but not a two-corner blitz.
Yeah,
so
that's interesting.
I like Keith Butler. He knows his personnel. He knows his head coach. He's learned from a year. I think a lot of people out here like Keith Butler.
That's Jim Wexel, folks, of the Steeler City Depot, also PFW correspondent. Lots of great stuff today. I'm sorry the time has went by so fast, but Jim, do you think we could invite you back on as the season approaches or right after we get underway and get another update on the Steelers?
Oh, absolutely. Steel City Insider, just a minor correction, steelcityinsider.net, and we're with the Scout Network. So I appreciate all the time you've given me. Arthur.
Thank you. We appreciate you giving it to us. And Jim, we will we'll be in touch somewhere very shortly down the road. Enjoy the rest of your downtime before camp opens.
Excellent. Thank you.
That's Jim Wexel, folks, of the Steel City Insider of the Scout Network. I hope I didn't screw that up a second time. I don't think I did. He provides excellent Steelers coverage. And again, we will be reconnecting with him as the season gets a little closer. We're halfway through our AFC North preview, but be sure and come back. We'll get you up to speed on the Bengals and the Browns right after a short break. Welcome back to Pro Football Weekly Podcast. So pleased you are here with us, and I'm extremely pleased to be joined next by Ken Brew of the ABC affiliate in Cincinnati and WLW, the flagship of the Cincinnati Bengals. Ken, get us up to speed a little bit on the reigning division champs. A lot of changes this offseason, but first, how are you doing today? Thank you for being with us.
Well, Arthur, thank you for having me on. I appreciate it. You know, I was a long, long time subscriber of Pro Football Weekly, and I love the pre-draft, and I love the preseason publications, and I'm just tickled to death that Pro Football Weekly is part of my life again, and I appreciate you having me on.
Thank you. The pleasure is certainly all ours, and yeah, we want to talk a little Bengals, a very interesting team, kind of for better and worse, obviously, but Ken, what is your biggest takeaway from the Bengals offseason after, obviously, what was a really disappointing conclusion in the playoffs, something, unfortunately, the Bengals have become too accustomed to over the past 5-6 years?
Well, they do a lot in January to make the season interesting, that's for sure. They save their worst for last, which winds up being the best of entertainment. And they've had an interesting offseason. They lost their second and third wide receivers in Mohamed Sanu and Marvin Jones. They lost the entire defensive side of the football, coaching-wise, with the exception of the defensive coordinator. And they lost their offensive coordinator, who's now the head coach in Cleveland. So there's been some upheaval. The core of this team remains intact, but the core of this team hasn't been good enough to win appreciably over the last 5 years. So it's kind of an interesting study. They've won 52 games over the last 5 years. There's been no Bengals team in the history of the franchise that's been that successful, but they haven't won, as you mentioned, in the playoffs, and they've had this tremendous amount of departure since the end of last season. So while I think the core of the team is good and should be competitive, I think it's going to be very interesting to watch things like chemistry and coach-to-player relationship, and like every team, whether or not the big stars can stay healthy.
Ken, I'm glad that's where you started. We're going around the division, and I've been asking a lot of personnel questions, but for me with the Bengals, it's more about what you just alluded to, the chemistry, the maturity, frankly, and I am going to start on defense for that reason. Do you think that Vontaze Burfict and or Adam Jones are going to learn from their past errors? And if they don't, do you think the Bengals' ceiling is what we've already seen, one and done in the playoffs?
Well, the Bengals think they will because they gave Adam Jones a three-year, $22 million contract in the offseason, $24 million contract in the offseason. So they think he will. And in all due respect to Adam, he was their best cornerback last year. Without question, he was their best cornerback. With regards to Burfict, a tremendously talented but undisciplined player, and it's not just what we saw at the end of the playoff game against the Steelers. This is a guy that doesn't tackle fundamentally well and has missed several games because of concussions. And he's a player that plays out of control when he's up against division opponents, in particular Pittsburgh. And I don't know where that comes. These red flags are what kept Vontaze Burfict from being drafted.
Right.
And although he's got a tremendous amount of talent, he also lacks a tremendous amount of discipline. So what you've asked is a question that I don't think there's any answer to until they get on the field. But I have no question about Adam Jones. I think Adam Jones is a tremendously talented player, and even at his age, is one of the better cornerbacks in the NFL. And on this team is the best cornerback that they have.
Right. And you could argue, too, in fairness with Adam Jones, you could say, well, what was Joey Porter doing on the field? It seems like, you know, we got to make sure not to kind of compare these two situations. Jones's unfortunate flag late in that playoff loss. And of course, Burfict just going after Antonio Brown. And that was weeks after he went after Max Williams. Just totally inexcusable headhunting. But let me come at it in a different direction. Marvin Lewis, is there any concern that after watching him lose control of these players on the sideline, and in my opinion, it's hard to debate that that's exactly what happened. Is there any concern that it lingers or that maybe some of the players view him at all differently? I know he's one of the better coaches in football and has absolutely turned this program around, but is there any of that stuff that could potentially linger, or is that not something that anyone's worried about?
Well, he's big on saying that every season's a different season and that the players that will comprise this team this year will be different than the ones that were on 2015. There will be turnover. But in truth, I think there has to be a lingering effect. Look, you hear the same voice saying the same things over and over again, and you don't have success, particularly when it counts, there's the tune-out factor. And it doesn't matter whether it's a football coach. It could be your boss in any other line of work. It could be your parent. If you don't see results and you hear the same voice, you're going to stop listening to that voice. I think the one thing that Marvin Lewis has always had with the players that he's coached, by and large, and there were some high profile exceptions, but by and large, he's always had their respect. Now, whether or not he's going to, finally turn that respect into results when the season really counts, I don't know. Marvin Lewis, I think, is coming down the home stretch here as a head coach. I think there are more years behind him than they are in front of him. He works for the most patient owner in the history of business. Forget about football. and as a guy in his position should have been gone 7-8 years ago. But I think the owner is at a point right now where he realizes the core for this team to win is here. And the opportunity for it to win, the window, if you will, is closing. So I think they've got to see something tangible from this team in January this year. Or I think it may not be a case of the players losing respect or tuning Marvin Lewis out. I think the owner's patience may run out.
Chatting here with Ken Brew. You can find him at the Bengals flagship WLW. You can also find him on Twitter at Ken Brew, B-R-O-O. And Ken, let me ask you, what concerns you more? And I want to talk just a little football. What concerns you more, the turnover in the secondary or the turnover in Andy Dalton's receiving core?
Well, yeah, I would say that if it's a choice between the two, it would be the secondary. It'd be the defensive secondary, and this is why. Defense is a reactionary position.
Mm-hmm.
Offense is it's the side of the football where there's more scheming and there's more play diagramming. You know what you're going to do, but the guy on the other side of the football thinks he knows what you're going to do, but isn't quite sure.
Right.
They have two cornerbacks in Dre Kirkpatrick and Darquez Dennard, who are young but injury-prone. Dennard really and truly has been injured every year since 2010, going back to his time at Michigan State. Kirkpatrick arrived here hurt. The first two years and change, he played hurt, missed games. Now he's in his contract year. Leon Hall, who was an aging veteran they let go last year, still had some skills. But you're down to really right now, on one side, you're going to probably start the rookie you drafted number one overall. On the other, number one in the last draft. The other guy is going to be Pac-Man Jones, who is probably in, I don't have it in front of me, probably going to be 34 by the start of the season.
Mm-hmm.
And you have Dennard and Kirkpatrick, who have this injury history we looked at. Your safety, your best safety from last year, is gone in Reggie Nelson. You know, on the offensive side of the ball, they drafted Tyler Boyd. I would like to see them sign Anquan Boldin. For some reason, they won't. Tanner Eifert, if he's healthy, is Andy Dalton's comfort zone. And I think you can say without much argument that A.J. Green is one of the top four or five wide receivers in the game. So I'm not concerned so much what Dalton has to throw to. My concern is on the defensive side of the ball, how are they going to stop the other guy throwing?
Okay. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And, you know, after I know that obviously the Browns have went back to the well in terms of drafting cornerbacks in the first round. I think, three out of the past five years now, the most recent William Jackson III out of Houston, everyone was so excited about him in the lead up to the draft. Obviously a small school corner, but with some pretty rare athletic traits. So interesting to hear that he is going to potentially have an early role for them. You know, one more name that you mentioned that I certainly need to get to, Tyler Eifert, obviously disappointing that we're again talking about injuries instead of his breakthrough campaign, one of the best tight ends in football last year. Just get us up to speed on his health status to the best of your knowledge, and what his expectations are for when he's going to be full tilt.
Well, he hasn't done anything so far. OTAs, mini camp, and all that. He was curtailed. For those of the listeners who may not know, he was hurt in the Pro Bowl. And they say he's going to be okay. They say he will be there when training camp starts here in a couple of weeks. We'll see. Again, he's Andy Dalton's security blanket. If he's not there, then they've got a major problem with their receiving core, because then you do really and truly have to rely on a rookie in Tyler Boyd and in Brandon LaFell, whom I think is, you know, I don't think anybody that is seriously contending would have Brandon LaFell as their second wide receiver. So it's really important that they have a healthy Tyler Eifert. Now, there's one other option that they have if they want to do it, and it'll be interesting to see if the new offensive coordinator, Ken Zampese, really and truly wants to do this. But Gio Bernard kind of like fell to the wayside with Jeremy Hill the last couple of years as Hill became the number one running back. Bernard can play in the slot. You can move him away from the backfield. He may become more of an option for them if indeed there's a problem with Eifert to begin the season. Not to play tight end, obviously, but to be more of an option for Andy Dalton.
Yeah, that's interesting. Being able to tap into Gio's versatility, that would make a lot of sense. Obviously, I shouldn't say it's obvious. I have no idea if the listeners know, but we know, of course, that the Bengals opted to give Giovanni Bernard a new deal. Jeremy Hill, of course, a year behind him, won't be up for a new one, I don't believe, until at least next year. But Hill also coming off the costly fumble in the playoffs. So I guess kind of tying it all together here, I have to ask about Hugh Jackson, too, because we've got a few minutes left, and I don't know how you feel about the transition from Jackson to Ken Zampese, but we've talked a lot about the loss of Sanu and the loss of Marvin Jones and potentially being without Tyler Eifert. Is Zampezi ready, and is there enough continuity for Andy Dalton? It's amazing we went this long without, I even think, mentioning Dalton's name to where he can pick up where he left off before the thumb injury. Or do you think there's some real concern there given, you know, Hugh Jackson's play calling acumen and Ken Zampezi's kind of newness to the whole situation?
Now, Zampezi has been a position coach for a long, long time. And that's both comforting in the fact that he has that longevity, but troubling that he never got a shot anywhere to be an offensive coordinator. I mean, when you think about it, if you're that good and you're that hot, why isn't someone else giving you a chance if your own team isn't? And he had Carson Palmer, and now he's got Andy Dalton, so he's had some big-time quarterbacks that get the job done. I don't know. See, that goes back to the uncertainty of where this team is right now. I don't know about Zampezi. I think he got the gig simply because he's the quarterback's coach, and there's a comfort level there for Andy Dalton. Now, we'll see exactly whether or not that philosophy works or whether or not they should have brought in someone who is used to putting together an entire offense and working with a quarterback as well. I do know this. Andy Dalton took big steps from 2 years ago to last year. He had a really good year last year. If you look at his stats and what he did under pressure from last year, from 2 years ago to last year, it's night and day improvement. The guy is getting a lot better. I don't know if he's at his ceiling yet. This is going to be a very big year for him because of all the changes that he's had on his side of the ball. But do I think he's a tough kid? You bet. Do I think he's a smart kid? You bet. But is he a guy that can make adaptations to changes and things like that? I don't know. We're going to find out here pretty soon.
Good stuff from Ken Brew, folks. That is Ken Brew from WLW, the flagship station of the Cincinnati Bengals. Ken, we are out of time, unfortunately, but we'd love to have you back on the program sooner than later because the Bengals are very talented and nothing if not interesting. We know that much.
Listen, you got my number. Don't lose it.
Absolutely. Ken, it's a pleasure. We will talk to you very soon. Thank you again to Ken Brew from WLW, the flagship of the Cincinnati Bengals. We are going to conclude our spin around the AFC North after a short break. We are still going to talk Cleveland Browns, and we're going to bring back a special guest and a voice you will recognize, our very own, formerly our very own, Nate Atkins will join us next. Welcome back to the Pro Football Weekly podcast. We are thrilled to welcome in our next guest. It will be a familiar voice, I'm sure. We have Nate Atkins, who just recently left PFW to head to the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, doing features and enterprise reporting on the Big Ten. And I believe it's the AJC's Land of Ten. Is that right, Nate?
Yep, that's it. Landof10.com. Just launched a couple weeks ago. So excited about that. And it's great to be back in the old PFW podcast. Glad I haven't been quite forgotten yet.
No, we would never. And we're glad to have such an awesome resource when it's time to talk Browns. That's what we're doing today, taking a spin around the AFC North as training camps approach. And of course, Nate was covering the Browns closely for us at PFW. He's been following them his whole life as a Northeast Ohio native. And Nate, I'm sure you're still basking in the Cleveland Cavaliers glow, but give us a reason right off the bat to be excited about the direction the Browns are headed, if you have one that you can think of.
Yeah, I tell you, it's an interesting time to move back here to Ohio, obviously, with what the Cavs did. And I went to the parade, and just to see that many Cleveland fans in one place, first off, and then to see them all happy about something in sports is pretty remarkable. And so now this is where they flip the page of the Browns, because as much as the Cavs have lit up this city, I mean, that's always going to be the favorite team here in Ohio and in Northeast Ohio specifically. And there are quite a bit off as far as the team goes, as far as roster and competing. But I do think people are pretty excited. I'm pretty excited about the direction, at least that they're attempting. And it's all going to come down to, is Jimmy Haslam going to have the patience to do this? Will he go through with it, as he says? But people are excited just about the fact that they're going in a different direction with this analytics movement, bringing in Paul Dave Podesta, the old Mets Moneyball guru guy, and just trying something that's so much different than what they've done before, which is just repeated failure of drafting quarterbacks in the first round, really moving up and then quickly head coaches too. And I think more than even that, because people are feeling those guys out a little bit, I think Hugh Jackson has really just become a symbol for this city and this area to think about. They got what was considered arguably the top coaching candidate on the market, either him or Adam Gase were usually in that conversation, to see a guy who was sort of downstate with the rival Bengals and leading them, you know, to a one of the most balanced offenses in the league, and a guy who's developed quarterbacks, and to have him actually choose Cleveland rather than go over to New York and even interview with the Giants, where he could have, you know, had a chance to coach Eli Manning and Odell Beckham Jr., should have been an offensive coordinator's dream. The fact that he bought into the analytics movement, as old school of a coach as he is, I think that's helped people out a little bit to get on board. And then they're just excited to see what he does. But obviously it's a patient level of excitement. Cautious is probably a better word, because they've been through this before, where you get jazzed for a hire and then it doesn't come through.
Yeah, Nate, it all sounds great. I got to be honest. And I think, you know, different directions certainly should be music to the ears of most who are following the Browns. I guess the one area I'm a little leery is requiring on patience from Jimmy Haslam. But I guess if you're going to take this far of a, you know, out of left field approach, there, you know, just inherently there has to be a certain level of patience that you're going to afford. So obviously we'll have to be kind of keyed in on that whole thing. But since no one thinks that the Browns are competing for a play, well, I'm pretty sure no one thinks the Browns are competing for the playoffs this year. What are the tangible signs that this thing is heading in the right direction that maybe we can look for? And maybe as soon as next month when camps open, what is important for you to see to kind of get the sense that the Browns actually have a clue?
Well, I think just the best you can go off right now is just the any sign that they have a plan and that they're going to stick to that plan. And that you can kind of see them giving it a chance and going with it. Because right now, like you said, this roster, it's not anywhere near a playoff contending roster. I don't think this year's record is going to justify one way or another whether this is a good idea or not. I think just what they want to see is them have a plan and that they're sticking to it and they're not just rewriting it after a couple of losses. And what I mean by that is you look back at this draft and the way that they moved down and they stockpiled picks, had 14, the most of any team in the draft. And you kind of saw a plan in there of some sort. The guys they brought in were these really blue collar guys who really had to sort of work through adversity throughout their career. And it can kind of be cliche, but it's sort of an attitude that Hugh Jackson wants to build here. You saw them draft five different pass catchers. People thought that was insane, but again, that's an approach to address the passing game, which they haven't done very well, especially at the receiver position in years. The two positions they've really ignored for a long time have been receiver and pass rusher, and that's what's taken over this league. That's why they've lagged behind the entire league for the past several years, and so for them to go right after them with their top three picks were right in those two areas, and a majority of their picks on both sides of the ball went right at those two areas. So I think people are intrigued by that. They're intrigued by the fact that as much as they've sort of flipped this roster over and let veterans go, there's a couple of guys that they do want to keep around, and they do value the leadership of them, and they're not going to completely blow it up, whether that's Joe Thomas or Joe Hayden or Paul Kruger, that they do value a sense of veteran leadership. And you kind of see, you know, to be a veteran on this team, you've got to be able to play, but they're not going to completely just blow everything up just in the name of writing it over. So there's a few signs out there, but I mean, like we said, everyone's going to be cautious, and there's really not going to be any sign that it's actually working for probably at least another year.
I obviously need to ask you about RG3. I do have a follow-up regarding the selection of five pass catchers in the NFL draft. But before I go there, you mentioned the rare holdovers, the rare veteran holdovers that did survive this offseason purge. One of them isn't a household name, but I think he is pretty valuable to this defense. Unfortunately, he is going to be unavailable to this defense in 2016. What do you make of the loss of Desmond Bryant to the torn, is it a pectoral muscle, I believe, in an offseason workout? How much does that affect what this defense is trying to do with Ray Horton?
Yeah, it certainly hurts, because not only were they counting on Desmond Bryant to bring along some of these young pass rushers, like a guy like Carl Nassib, they took in the third round out of Penn State to develop him for that five tech spot. They were leaning on him also to produce. I mean, he was their leading sacker last year, even though it's only six sacks. I mean, that's something out of a five tech spot that they were hoping to combine with a pass rush at the outside linebacker spots, and it's not going to be there. And now you look at their defensive line, and it looks embarrassingly thin right now. Desmond Bryant's out. You've got Armani Bryant, who is their second leading sacker. He's suspended for 4 games, and it might be more based on what comes out of his latest arrest. You've got Xavier Cooper's right now probably going to start at a 5-tech spot, and he's, you know, was incredibly unimpressive last year, just really underweight. And Danny Shelton, they feel good about, and he's dropped a lot of weight, but I mean, he wasn't a 3-down player last year either. So there's really not a single guy up front right now for this team that you look at and you say he can play all 3 downs and we feel good about him. And that's just going to kind of go into this whole idea of a long rebuild that they're going to have. It's going to be rough going in the early start, especially in a brutal league like the AFC North, where teams like Cincinnati and Pittsburgh can run them as well as anyone.
Yeah, no kidding. And what about in the opposite side of the ball in the trenches? Obviously, a ton of turnover. You lose Alex Mack. You lose Mitchell Schwartz. But interestingly, there actually is a lot of high-priced investments. Now, granted, they're from the prior regime, of course, when you're talking about Cam Irving, Joel Bitonio. If you go much further back, of course, the perennial All-Pro, future Hall of Famer Joe Thomas. But specifically with Irving and Bitonio, and I guess just on a bigger, from a wider view, are there guys that you think are going to turn into nice assets that this new regime that Sashi Brown, Paulo DePodesta inherited? And have you seen enough from either Bitonio or Irving to think maybe they fall in that category?
I think we saw enough from Bitonio in his rookie year 2 years ago to get excited. I mean, just the way he gets out in front of linebackers and really opens up the running game. He sort of stepped back a little bit last year, and last year obviously was a train wreck in a lot of ways for this team, but he's one that I think you see some value there, maybe a ceiling as well, but he's a guy that could develop in that role. I mean, Cam Irving is just a tricky one because they drafted him to be the center of the future, and they played him at right guard last year, and he was an absolute disaster at right guard. I mean, and it really came down to just the way he started plays off. I mean, he was just a penalty machine. He just got beat right away, and so they think moving him back into center, you know, if he can get into a more natural position that he played his last year at Florida State, they're going to kind of see. But it's a really tough read based on last year because he was as bad as anyone to watch out there on the field. But, I mean, Joe Thomas, he is what he is. You know, he's perhaps the best offensive lineman in the NFL. I mean, he's getting a little older, but he's been so rock solid, has never even missed a single snap in an NFL game. So they're glad to have him back, and I think – Hugh Jackson knows the importance of a left tackle with what Andrew Whitworth did, locking things down on the left side for him over in Cincinnati. It's going to be crucial to develop any quarterback. So I think he's thrilled to have a guy like that to bring over because there's not a whole lot that they inherited that I think they look to keep for a while.
Right. Yeah, who wouldn't be excited to get Joe Thomas? Obviously, just an absolute stud and about as stable and solid, as durable as they come in the NFL. I think really the only question with Thomas is if he is still going to be on this roster come the trade deadline in October or November. A potential move may be still coming. We'll have to wait and see. But Nate, I saved the best for last. I don't know if it's the best, but certainly the most interesting. The RG3 and the Hugh Jackson dynamic. I'm sure you've read the reports about how RG3 actually wasn't very good in the offseason. I don't know if you've been able to glean any more or if you've been able to kind of substantiate any of that. I have this working theory that maybe Hugh Jackson isn't too disappointed to see some of those reports out there because it's one more thing that's going to sort of test RG3's adversity and kind of test this new and improved RG3 both on and off the field. What do you make, A, of those reports and B, of maybe what we could see from this pairing this year?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not surprised to hear that it started off slow for RG3. I mean, this is a guy that didn't play a single snap in an NFL game last year and really needs to have a lot of his approach completely recalibrated. But I mean, it's also hard to really judge a guy like that until you see him in what they call the live bullets type setting. I mean, when he came in and worked out for the Browns, that's reportedly when he blew them away. Now, is blowing away the Cleveland Browns as a quarterback, is that really a compliment? I'm not real sure. But I mean, as far as the reports come out, does Hugh Jackson like this? Is it a good thing? He wants to challenge this guy. He wants to hold him accountable and let him know. Yeah, at one point a team traded all the way up to the number 2 pick to get you, but you're no longer that sort of status here. And right now he's under a contract, and I think he knows that if he doesn't perform this season, they can get out of it for next year and move on. And this could very well be his last real chance to step in and have a potential starting role and sort of reach the potential that he had coming out of the draft. So it doesn't really change a whole lot for me. He's really, to me, the ultimate wild card where I could see it go very, very well, and I could see it over after week one.
Yeah, it's going to be fun to watch, and I do agree with you. It is kind of a coin flip to see how this thing goes. I actually am kind of in the minority. I think it can work just because that Hugh Jackson RG3 dynamic can be pretty good. I think Jackson is going to tailor the offense to RG3's strengths. I don't think we're going to see him try and be a pocket passer, but who knows? I'll end with this, Nate. We are short on time, unfortunately, but getting back to that slew of pass catchers that Cleveland brought in, kind of two-part question. Is there someone other than Corey Coleman that excites you a lot, or is this really, as the first rounder, is this kind of Coleman's gig and he's just going to have to deal with it and hopefully produce right away? And then the other part of it, was the writing on the wall for Josh Gordon on May 1st, on May 2nd, whenever all these guys arrived? Is it a signal, in your opinion, that maybe Josh Gordon isn't part of the Browns' plans moving forward, perhaps even if the NFL does, in fact, reinstate him in a couple weeks?
Well, I think the fact that they've kept him around and they've sort of dealt with the uncertainty of it and the negative headlines that are out there regarding him shows that they're willing to give it a chance and see what he can do. And, I mean, I think Hugh Jackson, the way he coached, you know, A.J. Green and a talent like that and what that did for Andy Dalton, I think he'd love to get Josh Gordon back on the field if he could. But The fact that they drafted this many guys shows they don't really believe it's going to happen. At least they're not banking on that. But they needed a lot more than one receiver. They cut Brian Hartline, who was in line to be the number one when Josh Gordon was gone. And so I do think they're looking to Corey Coleman, and he's got to be the guy who steps up and right away is sort of showing signs that this can be a number one type receiver down the line at some point. And the other guys they have, I mean, they drafted a bunch of different skills here. They have a real technically sound guy like in Jordan Payton out of UCLA. They have a sort of break the distance type potential in Ricardo Lewis, and they both have a lot of flaws, and they're just going to have them come in and compete and see kind of how the cream rises to the crop. But they're not all going to make the roster, but I think they'll get excited about the guys who do, because they need something at that position right now.
Well, I'll tell you, Nate, I still think it's going to be interesting. The personnel obviously is lacking, but in Hugh Jackson and Ray Horton, the Browns actually now have two of my favorite play callers in the NFL. You will not see any shortage of aggression, any shortage of things outside the box from this pair. So, you know, for Browns fans, I think it's at least going to be fun to watch. We'll wait and see if the direction is the right one that they've chosen. But that's all the time we have for today with Nate Atkins. You can follow Nate on Twitter at Nate Atkins, and make sure you're following him on his latest venture, thelandof10.com, Atlanta Journal-Constitution's Land of 10, where Nate is going to be doing features and enterprise reporting on the Big Ten. Nate, I can't wait to see what you guys are up to over there, and I can't wait to have you back on the program. I know you won't be a stranger.
No, not at all. I'm glad to be on here anytime you guys want to have me, and always happy to check in with you guys. It was a fun ride there for 2 years, and looking forward to what else you guys turn out.
Outstanding. Thank you again, Nate. That's going to do it for today's edition of Pro Football Weekly Podcast. As always, we have some thank yous to take care of. All terrific guests on today's program. I also need to thank our wonderful producer, Dan Mott. Most of all, I have to thank you, the listener, for coming back and being with us as always. I am your host, Arthur Arkish, and we hope you will be back next week for another division preview on the Pro Football Weekly Podcast.
The Shaw Media Podcast Network has a lot of really great sports podcasts, but are you more than just a sports fan?
You need to be listening to The Unprintable Podcast, which is a pop culture podcast with voices from journalists like myself, Nicole Franz.
And me, Jason Frummer.
As we discuss TV, movies, and of course, Jason's favorite subject,
music.
We'll also have some arts coverage, and you can catch special guests and exclusive interviews.
It's all right here on Unprintable. You can find us in the Shaw Media Podcast Network, available on Blog Talk Radio, iTunes, and Stitcher.
Hi, everyone. This is Hub Arkish, executive editor of Pro Football Weekly, and I'm here to let you know that Pro Football Weekly is back. To celebrate, we're giving away a collector's edition hoodie a day for the next 60 days. Just go to profootballweekly.com/hoodie, enter your email, and if you've won, we'll email you right back. While you're there, check out the site. You want an insider's guide to the NFL? Go to profootballweekly.com for all the news and analysis you won't find anywhere else. Pro Football Weekly, the best coverage in the NFL since 1967.